1. Before parasites were cool. It's not easy being a parasite. Sure, you get a free meal, but the life of a moocher still comes with plenty of stresses. You have to be able to adapt to the environment inside 1, 2, or if you belong to a class of parasitic worms known as trematodes, 3 different hosts, habitats that can be as different from each other as the Earth is from the moon. And getting from one to the next can be a logistical nightmare. Imagine you're a trematode that spends part of life inside an ant, but can only sexually reproduce inside the bile duct of a sheep. Ants aren't on a sheep's normal menu, so how do you make it to your next destination? The answer to that question is what sent Janice Moore on her life's path. In 1971, she was a senior at Rice University in Houston, sitting in an introductory course on parasitology taught by a titan in the field, Clark Reed, a lanky man with a commanding presence and an odd style of lecturing. He would puff away on a cigarette and seemingly free associate, drawing students into his passion with fascinating details about different species of parasites that he presented with no discernible regard for logic or order. But he was a gifted storyteller who could evoke the lives of parasites so richly that you could almost picture what it was like to be one. He also knew how to spin a good mystery, which was how he ensnared Moore. She couldn't imagine how to get an ant into a sheep's mouth, in spite of Reed's admonishment to think like a trematode. In fact, no one could, because the solution the parasite lit upon is absurdly improbable. It invades a region of the ant's brain that controls its locomotion and mouthparts. During the day, the infected insect behaves no differently than any other ant. But at night, it does not return to its colony. Instead, it climbs to the top of a blade of grass and clamps onto it with its mandibles. There, it dangles in the air, waiting for a grazing sheep to come by and eat it. If that doesn't happen by the next morning, however, it returns to its colony. Why doesn't it just stay attached to the leaf? Asked Reed, scanning the classroom as if he expected his students to discern the trematode's logic. Because otherwise, he told his rapt audience, the ant will fry to death in the noonday sun, an undesirable outcome for the parasite, which will perish with it. So up and down the ant goes, night after night, until an unsuspecting sheep eats the ant-laden blade of grass, and the parasite finally ends up in the sheep's belly. Reed's tale stunned Moore. The trematode called to mind a comic book arch-villain who controls minds with a joystick, causing law-abiding citizens to rob banks and commit other crimes so the villain can take over the world. The report of the trematode's astonishing feat came from a German study done in the 1950s, but, thrilling Moore, Reed had just learned of research being done on a different organism that was producing findings similar to the Germans. The protagonist of this tale was a thorny-headed worm, a parasite with a spiky head and a flaccid body that looks like a 5 to 10 millimeter worm-shaped sac. Before assuming its adult form, the parasite must mature inside tiny, shrimp-like crustaceans that live in ponds or lakes, and that usually burrow into mud at the first sign of trouble. For the next stage of the worm's development, however, it needs to get inside the gut of a mallard, beaver, or muskrat, all creatures that live on the water's surface and feed on the crustaceans. To determine how the stowaway manages to jump ship, John Holmes, a former student of Reed's who had become a professor at the University of Alberta, and his graduate student, William Bethel, brought crustaceans into the lab. Infected ones, they discovered, did exactly what they shouldn't. Instead of diving downward when agitated, they shot to the surface and skittered around, all but crying, "Look at me." If that failed to draw attention, they clung to vegetation that waterfowl and aquatic mammals liked to eat. Some, Moore was amazed to learn, even attached themselves to the webbed feet of ducks and were promptly swallowed. Another intriguing detail grabbed her attention. Occasionally, the Canadian investigators found the crustaceans harbored a different species of thorny-headed worm. When infected with this variety, their tests showed, the crustaceans also swam upward in response to any disturbance, but they congregated in well-lit areas frequented by scop, deep-diving ducks. As it turned out, that particular parasite's next host. Many interactions between predators and prey, thought Moore, were not what they appeared to be, but rather were rigged by parasites. Perhaps biologists, who couldn't see what was happening out of view, had been hoodwinked. What's more, if parasites were not just swinging a sledgehammer, directly killing and sickening hosts, but also bringing ill upon them by subtly changing their behavior, the ecological implications were enormous. It meant that these tiny organisms were taking animals out of one habitat and putting them in another, with unknown effects that would ripple through the food chain. When the class ended, she rushed up to Reed. "This is what I want to study," she announced, brimming with excitement. He applauded her decision as an adventurous one, and they hatched a plan for her future. "You'll need to get a master's in animal behavior, and then you should get a PhD in parasitology," he advised. And she did exactly that. 4 decades later, she looked back on that day with amusement. "I was bright-eyed, enthusiastic, and totally ignorant of the obstacles in the way," she said, breaking into a deep-throated laugh at the thought of her youthful optimism. Vivacious, with short, wavy hair, Moore still has a trace of a Texas twang, and she has a vibrant, confident style. Now a professor of biology at Colorado State University, she has arguably worked harder than anyone else to awaken the biology community to the game-changing nature of parasitic manipulations and encourage a new generation of scientists to take up that cause. Her pioneering studies, and more important, her writings, have shone a spotlight on the myriad ways parasites bend hosts to their will and on their subversive, often underappreciated role in ecology. Predators, in her view, may not always be the supreme hunters nature documentaries suggest they are. A significant portion of their catch of the day may be low-hanging fruit brought within their reach, courtesy of parasites. Why, after all, work hard for a meal when it will come to you? Perhaps the most heretical notion of the field she helped found is simply that one should not assume animals are always acting of their own volition. Numerous crustaceans, mollusks, fish, and literally truckloads of insects, according to Moore, are behaving weirdly because of parasites. Mammals like ourselves appear to be less common victims of their manipulations, but that belief may derive from ignorance, she cautioned. This much she's certain of. An undiscovered universe of animal behavior will yet be traced to parasites. Their meddling, in her view, is just harder to prove in some species than others. Moore and a growing cadre of like-minded scientists are making progress in their mission, but it's been a long haul, as the reason for our first meeting in the spring of 2012 underscored. We'd both traveled thousands of miles to a bucolic corner of Tuscany, Italy, to attend the first ever scientific conference devoted solely to parasitic manipulations. Sponsored by the prestigious Journal of Experimental Biology, the historic event drew a few dozen researchers from all over the world, a tribute to how far the discipline had come, but also an occasion to reflect on how much further it would have to go to attain stature commensurate with its importance. While Moore was delighted that their work was starting to make waves beyond their tiny specialty, she was frustrated that many scientists still failed to grasp how pervasive parasitic manipulations were in nature. Even in many quarters of biology, they're often viewed as little more than cute tricks or one-of-a-kind novelties, she complained. Another challenge facing neuroparasitology is semantic. Defining what exactly constitutes a manipulation, she said, can be tricky in itself. Technically, she and most of her colleagues concur, the term refers to a behavior a parasite induces in its host that benefits the parasite's transmission at the expense of the host's reproductive success. But that seemingly straightforward definition can be surprisingly murky when applied to the real world. If a cold germ makes you cough uncontrollably, for example, is that your body trying to clear the infection from your lungs, or the parasite tickling the back of your throat so that you'll spread the germ? Or consider this. Barnyard hens are probably more inclined to eat crickets infected with parasites that damage the insect's muscles, since those crickets are slower and thus easier to catch. The parasite needs to get into the hen to reproduce. But is it truly manipulating the cricket or merely hurting it? By contrast, few people, on hearing of the ant that climbs a grass blade in response to a trematode invading its brain, would discount the insect's behavior as a mere side effect of illness. So how far do you expand the definition of manipulation? Moore admits it's not always an easy call, but it amazes her that even when the evidence for a behavior being a manipulation is clear-cut, you might not know it from the cautionary tone of many researchers' reports. After one scientist's talk, she observed, "Almost every paper I've reviewed in the last year has the same disclaimer, almost verbatim. The alteration in the host's behavior may be due to a manipulation by the parasite or a pathology. When are we going to have the confidence to say something is not just a byproduct of disease, but obviously a manipulation?" Her colleagues nodded in agreement. Afterward, I asked her why researchers might be timid about expressing their views. "Because reviewers almost always insist that you stick in that qualifier, or they won't accept it for publication," she replied. "Ideas that challenge the status quo tend to be resisted, and pathology," she said, "is the default explanation, the conservative fallback position, even if it's the least likely possibility. The rigid either-or thinking that traditional-minded biologists often bring to the topic also rankles more. The conduct of parasites and hosts locked in battle cannot always be neatly sorted into piles," she said. "Maybe your cough represents both your body's effort to expel the germ and the parasite's determination to spread itself. Even enemies can share the same goals. Insisting that a parasite-induced behavior perfectly fit the profile of a manipulation to warrant scientific interest is equal folly, in her view." To illustrate her point, Moore noted that one of her graduate students had recently found that dung beetles dug shallower burrows and ate 25% less dung when they became infected with roundworms. "That's of huge ecological importance," she emphasized. "Australia actually had to import dung beetles because they were up to their ears in dung. Here's a beetle that's an ecosystem engineer, that is itself being engineered by the parasite. So we submit this to the Journal of Behavioral Ecology, and the editor does not even send it out for a review. He writes back, 'This is obviously simply a case of pathology.' As if in the context it even mattered. It was exasperating." If Moore sometimes sounds piqued about preaching to the unenlightened, it's understandable. Especially at the outset of her career, she often felt like a lone wolf howling in the wilderness. Her ideas were not so much disparaged as ignored. At the time she had her epiphany in Clark Reed's class, many biologists turned their nose up at parasites, deeming them too primitive and repugnant to be worthy of examination. Birds with fancy plumage and majestic mammals like elephants and lions were considered more appropriate subjects of study. Parasites, insofar as they received any attention, were almost exclusively the domain of veterinarians or medical researchers seeking to stem the tide of epidemics like malaria and cholera. Few people were concerned about their ecological impact, much less the possibility that they could boss around more estimable animals. Into this world stepped Moore, a young woman espousing that very view. She was not only a maverick, but also, by her own admission, hopelessly naive. After getting a master's in animal behavior at the University of Texas at Austin, she proceeded to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore to begin her PhD in parasitology, at which point she assumed she could dive straight into her area of interest. "I hadn't a clue how research was actually conducted. that graduate students don't get to set their own research agenda, but rather are expected to work on whatever is the pet interest of their advisor. As it turned out, that person wanted her to throw her energy into studying the biochemistry of tapeworms, a topic that held no appeal for her. Compounding her difficulty adjusting to Hopkins, Moore was the only female graduate student in the department and felt isolated from her peers. As a result, she had little sense of what others perceived to be important issues in the field, which ironically may have helped as well as hindered her development as a scientist. When I asked Moore if her ignorance might have freed her to think outside the box, she shot back, "I didn't even know there was a box." She was a misfit in still other ways. Science is inherently reductive. Its ethos is to break big problems down into smaller chunks that can be more easily attacked. But Moore has always been a big picture person. She sees connections between almost everything she learns and likes to synthesize information. As an undergraduate, she agonized over choosing a major, ultimately settling on biology owing to its breadth. The study of every living thing on Earth shouldn't constrain her too much, she thought. When it came time to decide on a specialty within that field, parasitology and animal behavior attracted her for similar reasons. This just seemed like about the most stuff you could ever pull together, and I was in a stage of life where I hadn't a clue that it's also extremely difficult to pull things together, which is why they tend not to be together, she said, again bursting into laughter at her younger self's gung-ho, climb-any-mountain mentality. Her grand vision of manipulating parasites, reordering food chains was thrilling to entertain, but she had no notion of how to design an experiment to test the sprawling concepts that crowded her mind. Hopkins, which had strong parasitology and ecology departments, had initially seemed the perfect place to learn that skill. But to Moore's disappointment, the groups were not closely connected. They perceived themselves to be studying very different things, she explained. Because she had no guidance as to how to bridge those disciplines, her goal of placing parasitic manipulations in a broader context seemed far beyond her reach. Further frustrating her, whenever she attempted to open others' eyes to the possibility that parasites might be puppeteers, she was not warmly received. At a seminar about the ecology of marine snails in the intertidal zone, she asked the scientist giving the lecture if he'd looked to see if trematodes were in the mollusks. Infected snails tended to be found in different places than those free of the parasite, she explained, citing a paper she'd just read. The researcher became visibly upset. From his perspective, he already had his hands full charting numerous factors impinging on the behavior of the snail. Migrating predators, shifting currents, daily fluctuations in temperatures, and more. And here she was suggesting that he should attend to yet something else. Moore was not unsympathetic to his view. Studying parasites in the field remains a daunting task to this day. But at the time, his reaction came as a heavy blow. Unable to see a way forward, Moore decided to drop out of Hopkins at the end of her first year. The Christmas prior, while back in Texas, she'd made plans to connect up with Reed, her former professor, who'd already indicated he might be willing to let her study parasitic manipulators under his supervision. But shortly before they were supposed to meet, he died unexpectedly of a heart attack, leaving Moore saddened and academically adrift. She made numerous inquiries at other universities in search of a PhD program that might offer her a comparable opportunity. But neuroparasitology was not even a gleam in a scientist's eye at that time. Even John Holmes, the Canadian scientist whose lab showed that some crustaceans were acting at the behest of parasites, was not actively pursuing that line of study. It was a side interest, he explained. Moore had hit a dead end. With no good options, she took a job at the University of Washington as a lab technician for an entomologist whose interests did not overlap with her own. But her luck was about to change. The scientist, Lynn Ridderford, was a rarity of that era, a woman who had risen to the top of her profession, and she proved to be a great role model. At her side, Moore learned how research projects were conceived, funded, and carried out, essentially the nuts and bolts of being a successful scientist. She came away from the experience empowered and with a new confidence in her ideas. Perhaps because she took herself more seriously, other people did too. After a 3-year detour, Moore was offered a place at the University of New Mexico in a unique PhD program that provided funding for students to design their own research projects. It was a big opportunity, and she didn't want to blow it. By then, she knew that she wouldn't be able to connect all the dots, that it would be a triumph simply to identify any parasitic manipulation not yet recognized, especially if she could show those manipulations made the hosts more appealing to their predators under field conditions. From Ritterford, she'd also learned the importance of designing a tight experiment, ideally one with a simple premise that was easy to execute. After searching through academic papers and textbooks for most of a semester, she finally believed she'd found the ideal subjects for her study. The parasite was a type of thorny-headed worm that cycled between two exceedingly common and easy-to-observe hosts, starlings and pill bugs, or roly-polies, as children often call them, owing to their tendency to curl up into balls when touched. With only a few hunches to go, Moore theorized that the parasite would make the pill bug behave in ways that would increase the insect's likelihood of being eaten by a starling. Her experimental apparatus consisted of a glass pie plate with nylon mesh stretched across most of the top, and an inverted pie plate for its cover. She placed a mixture of infected and uninfected pill bugs on top of the mesh, and then introduced a different type of salt on each side of the divider, creating one chamber with low humidity and one with high. Pill bugs that harbored the parasite, she discovered, were much more likely to gravitate toward the low humidity zone. In the wild, dry areas coincide with exposed locations, so she assumed the behavior of the infected pill bugs would make them more vulnerable to predation. In another experiment, she built a shelter by placing a tile on top of 4 stones, one at each corner. Infected pill bugs preferred to be out in the open more than the uninfected ones did. In yet another experiment, she covered one half of a pie plate with black gravel and the other with white gravel to test whether the parasite affected the host's ability to camouflage itself. Because pill bugs are black, she theorized that infected ones would be more likely to hang out on the white gravel, where they'd be conspicuous to birds. Indeed, that's exactly what she found. She'd proven her thesis in the lab, but would her findings hold up in the field? Owing to the difficulty of studying parasites in their natural habitat, no scientist had been able to measure the ecological impact of a manipulation. But Moore had a clever plan to do just that. She set up nest boxes for starlings on the campus during breeding season. She tied pipe cleaners around the throats of the starling nestlings, just tight enough to prevent them from swallowing, but loose enough not to hurt them. Then she collected the prey that their parents fed them and proceeded to dissect any pill bugs among the day's capture. She found that almost 1/3 of starling babies had been fed infected pill bugs, even though less than 0.5% of pill bugs in the vicinity of the nest boxes harbored the parasite. Clearly, the changes the parasite induced in the habits of its hosts had made them far more attractive prey. One or two examples of parasites with remarkable manipulative powers can easily be brushed aside as bizarre aberrations. Intriguing, to be sure, but hardly more than a footnote to our understanding of natural selection. But more examples begin to look like a trend. When Moore's results appeared in the journal Ecology in 1983, they attracted attention not only for that reason, but also because of a broader development sweeping biology. After long being shunned as disgusting lowlifes, parasites were starting to be embraced as objects of fascination and even admiration. As Moore put it, they became cool. Just why this happened isn't clear. Science, like all fields, is subject to fads, but coinciding with her starling studies, a flurry of papers pointing out the ecological importance of parasites began appearing in scientific journals, and they were penned by giants in evolutionary biology, like Robert May, Roy Anderson, and Peter Price. Around the same time, another prominent evolutionary biologist, Richard Dawkins, published a popular book, The Extended Phenotype, that touched more closely on the theme of parasitic manipulation. In the book, he argued that whether a gene is passed down depends not just on how it affects the characteristics, or phenotype, of the body in which it resides, but also on its impact on other animals. In that category, he cited as one example, natural selection favoring parasites that change a host's behavior to propagate their own genes. Parasites' sudden rise in popularity worked in Moore's favor. Editors at Scientific American, a magazine with a reputation for presenting cutting-edge research, invited her to write an overview article that would place her pill bug findings in a larger framework. In addition to highlighting the German and Canadian studies, she combed the scientific literature for other noteworthy cases of parasitic manipulations that had been ignored or overlooked, and then explained their significance in lively, accessible prose. One of the most familiar literary devices in science fiction is alien parasites that invade a human host, forcing him to do their bidding as they multiply and spread to other hapless earthlings. She began the article in the May 1984 issue of the publication. Yet the notion that a parasite can alter the behavior of another organism is not mere fiction. The phenomenon is not even rare. One need only look in a lake, field, or a forest to find it. Soon the manipulation hypothesis, as it became known, was being discussed with great interest in scientific circles. As Louis Pasteur famously remarked, "Chance favors the prepared mind." Once word spread that parasites might be dictators in disguise, more people began to notice animals behaving strangely, and inquiring minds wondered whether infectious organisms might be to blame. Despite scientists' excitement about the idea, however, the field's popularity proved fleeting. The practical challenges of doing the research quickly dimmed enthusiasm for it. Observing animal behavior is an arduous undertaking even before parasites enter the picture. It can entail spending endless hours submerged underwater in scuba gear, hanging from a harness at the top of a forest canopy, or searching through swampland with a flashlight in the middle of the night. Since a parasite may have two or three hosts, just working out the details of its life cycle can be a Herculean task. To add to the challenge, estimating infection rates in each population usually means catching dozens or hundreds of potential hosts and either drawing blood from the animals, collecting their feces, or killing and dissecting them. Then, assuming you clear all those hurdles, comes the really hard part: determining whether the hitchhiker actually is manipulating the host, and if so, how and for what purpose. That's best done in the lab, but many animals aren't inclined to go about their everyday activities in captivity. Humans may be more cooperative subjects, but scientists who suspect that mental illness or other aberrant behavior might be linked to parasites hit an even bigger obstacle. They can't infect people with their bug of choice and then watch to see if the subject's habits or dispositions change. Not surprisingly, researchers with the patience and perseverance to pursue such work are hard to find. Which is why, even today, there's a tendency to focus on the interplay of predator and prey, and ignore the hidden passenger that might have a very different agenda than the vehicle it's riding inside. Nonetheless, by the turn of the millennium, scientists had succeeded in uncovering several dozen parasitic manipulations affecting hosts across virtually every branch of the animal kingdom. Always the synthesizer, Moore in 2002 compiled all known cases into a book, Parasites and the Behavior of Animals, still viewed as a Bible in the field. Her goal in writing it was to inspire creative thinking about how parasites work their black magic, and to uncover unifying principles. How often, she tried to determine, do they target the central nervous system of the host? Do closely related species employ similar coercive strategies? Could very complex manipulations have simple underpinnings? Above all, her ruminations focused on a question that had captivated her since she was a student in Clark Reed's class. Can you predict the behavior of animals by the parasites inside them? Moore is still trying to answer those questions. Patterns are emerging, but details remain sketchy, she admits. And the task at hand keeps getting bigger. Hundreds more parasites are now suspected of being manipulators, and the true number, she speculates, may be in the thousands. We just haven't bumbled across them yet, she said. And not just because of the difficulty of studying animal behavior or the taboo against experimenting on humans. Perhaps our biggest handicap is that we're imprisoned by our senses. Quite simply, we rely too heavily on our eyes for our understanding of the world. In the talk Moore gave at the conference, she emphasized that point by recounting the story of the discovery of bat echolocation. Since the 18th century, investigators have known that blindfolded bats can deftly navigate between silk wires, but bats whose ears are sealed crash to the ground. Yet, for over 150 years, scientists refused to believe that the animals could hear what humans could not. In the early 1940s, advances in detecting sounds in the ultrasonic range demonstrated that bats could hear the echo of their own cries. Yet the notion that they might use that skill to navigate was still not fully accepted until the military declassified documents after World War II, revealing the development of radar and sonar. With that in mind, said Moore, it's worth nothing that most of the manipulations we know of today can be viewed with the naked eye. The intermediate host positions itself against a high-contrast background, or moves around frenetically, or is someplace where it wouldn't ordinarily go. Because this attracts human attention, we can readily understand why it would be noticed by a predator that is the parasite's next host. But what if a parasite effectively puts a target on an animal's back by altering aspects of its behavior that are invisible to our senses? Perhaps, for example, it induces its host to lay down a scent trail that our noses can't smell, or causes it to emit sounds beyond our hearing range, or prompts it to expose body parts that look drably colored to us, but are vivid to the parasite's next host. That marked animal inviting predation may even be one of us. As we shall see later, some parasites that cause terrible scourges are now suspected of enhancing their transmission by altering human body odor. Given these possibilities, said Moore, how can we fail to wonder what manipulations we are missing in this wild world of information that lies just beyond our senses? A colleague who stepped up to the podium immediately after that, biologist Robert Poulin, from the University of Otago in New Zealand, agreed that scientists were missing thousands of manipulations, but, interestingly, presented a reason different from any she'd proposed. Many manipulators, he pointed out, may cause merely the tiniest shifts in a host's normal habits, something that could be overlooked when scientists compare the average behavior of a host population to the uninfected group. For example, parasites may slightly modify how often animals go one place or another, alter the time of day they're most active, or prompt hosts to act in an ordinary manner but in the wrong context. An infective bird pecks the ground, while the rest of the flock takes wing, for instance. Predators are highly attuned to anything that makes prey stand out in the least way. So this strategy would likely be highly effective, he suggested. Also, this kind of minor tweak should not be a difficult one to pull off. Hence, evolution might have favored this simple gambit. What this implies for humans is that we may need to study behavior with a finer-tooth comb to detect parasites' influence on us. For example, attempting to link suspected meddlers not just to flagrant mental illness, but also to more subtle shifts in personality and habits that are well within human norms. Fortunately, it's now easier to test these kinds of theories and get answers to some of the big questions posed by the science. As the discovery of bat echolocation demonstrates, it often takes technological advances before new frontiers can be broached, and, heartening in that regard, science is finally starting to catch up with the sophistication of parasites. Over the past decade, the tools for getting at the mechanisms behind manipulations have advanced dramatically. As a result, researchers have far better methods for imaging parasites within the host's body and for identifying the genes, neurotransmitters, hormones, and immune cells involved in these behavioral changes. There are few manipulations that have been worked out in their entirety, but as the next few chapters will reveal, scientists now have some excellent clues. That's great news, for if we are to think like a trematode, we will need to understand its tricks.